very first episode of A Card Knock Life. We're happy to be here with you talking Magic, specifically competitive, constructed, standard, legacy, and modern. We are a bunch of tournament grinders and spikes and financiers that all met in Madison playing Magic for quite a long time and have since kind of disbanded and gone to our different parts of the state and in some cases the country. We are going to be covering a little bit of the pre-release weekend that just happened and talking about the implications on the new set in constructed formats, and also going into a juicy deck tech. Daryl here, who we'll introduce in a second, has got a five-color modern control deck that's actually been performing pretty well, and it's pretty fun to play. We're going to start out with an introduction here, so I will hand things off to the first host, who is John Galley.
Sure. I have played Magic since Revised, and usually been playing red decks, as most of you guys know here. But I've had my share of experiences in Magic, mostly competitive. And still trying to make the Pro Tour.
Okay. Cool. That was very much less than a minute. Now we're going to hand it
you
off to
you. You had a recent success, though, John.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Made some top eights, but still chasing the dream.
All right.
Now this is Brandy No Fetch Brainstorm Semerow.
Thank you. So my name is Brandon Semerow, not Semerow. All right. and I am a Magic player with Wizards very much has by the balls. I don't think I could ever quit this game. And I've probably been playing since before they dropped. So some of my Magic greatest hits, if we had to do this like a pop record, it'd probably have about three decent songs and the rest filler, like any basic Creed album. We'd have 2012 Legacy Mono Blue, 2012 Standard Junk Tokens, and 2015 Legacy Lands. Bonus album, 2014's Bombardment. And, yeah, that's all I have to say. Everything else is basically filler.
All right, cool. So next up is Zhu Ming.
All right. My name is Zhu Ming. I have been playing longer than any of these guys. I've been playing since Return to Ravnica. And I started off in Standard and quickly stopped playing Standard and moved on to Legacy. And that is primarily what I play, along with EDH. I don't have any crowning achievements, but I do beat Mr. Brandon Semerow all the time. So I've got that going for me.
Yeah, that's because you joined the Legacy Master Race, as far as formats are concerned.
That's right. Off to you, Daryl.
Yeah, Daryl is up next. Hey, guys, we've got like some sort of like ring interference sound going on. Much like the murderous child from the movie speaking into the phone. Daryl's up next.
All right, Daryl Faulkner. I've started playing in Mirrodin and Onslaught. I like to watch paint dry, so I play a lot of Control. The greatest hits album, Control 2014, Drown Yard. Control 2013, also Drown Yard. Control 2013, also Keswick Wolf Run. Miracles 2014, top two in SCG. I like to play a lot of Legacy. I've kind of faded away from Standard, so Legacy and Modern are formats I'm playing. And you probably won't see me point a Goblin Guy at anyone anytime soon.
And Daryl, these are all Pro Tour victories, of course, right?
No, two PTQ top eights, a 5K 16th place, and then a top two in SCG event.
Very nice. All right, I am Corey, and I have been playing since the middle school ages. Bought a box of Mercadian Masks, and my greatest hits started shortly thereafter with FNM Top 4, March 31st, 2003, at 7 o'clock p.m. I've got it written down as a tattoo on my arm. No, I'm just making that up. But basically, I am a... I play competitive Magic, but I have not top aided a Pro Tour qualifier of any sort at that point. So I'm gonna leave it to the March whatever the heck. FNM top four. Anyways, we are We are going to be a competitive constructed podcast, and we've talked a little bit about what our format's going to be, but I'm sure that can evolve as we go on. We've got a couple of things to go over today, as it is the pre-release weekend, or, you know, we're just coming off the pre-release weekend. We'd be remiss not to talk about our experiences there and how those things can relate to the big three, Standard, Modern, and Legacy. But we are going to start out with something that that I believe Brandon came up with, which is rather than going through the spoiler on the whole set, we're going to focus in a little bit on three picks from each person. There's an MFK, the Marry, Finance, and Kill. That's what the F always stood for. You were always told wrong. And so the Marry card is one that that was hyped up and maybe deserves the hype and is probably going to fit into a constructed deck after all, especially after our experiences actually playing them this weekend. The Finance pick is going to be one that is more, you know, flies under the radar and is probably going to pick up some steam, pick up some momentum as we go here and potentially be worth some money and potentially be played, even though it may be pre-ordered, you know, under $2 or something at this point. And then Kill is one that is hyped up and is has a high pre-order value, but will likely just be a total flop at some point. So we'll start out here with John. John, are you still on the call?
Yeah, I'm here with you. Yes.
All right, John's got a pending.
You'll have to forgive me on this Marry Kill thing because I hadn't heard the phrase before, so I'm gonna have to wing it here. But all right, so Marry is the that's the good one, right?
Yeah,
correct.
Okay, I think that the new Narsh set is pretty incredible. Hopefully, I'm not stealing Daryl's thunder here, but
you might be.
I played against it a decent amount this week online, and that card's just unreal. Like, the whole buying back and hostilities and then casting Elspeth is a pretty real thing that happens. So that's definitely, I think, my hot pick.
So you saw it in combination with Elspeth?
Yeah, so I was playing against a couple blue-white control decks, and they basically went, like, Banishing Light into Narset into End Hostilities with Rebound into Elspeth Sun's Champion. Oof. And, yeah, that was pretty brutal. I don't know. I don't think a lot of aggro decks have good weight against that. I was playing a deck.
Exactly what someone should be doing. Just everything dies all the time.
Mm-hmm. I was playing against it with an aggro deck that I had been having a lot of success with, and I just got, like, stuffed in my tracks. And then post-board, he brought in, like, Nyx Fleece Ram, and it just looked like good blue-white cards.
Cool. Sounds like a good marriage.
What is the, what's the next one that we got here?
You got Finance. That's something that you might be specking on.
I think the Finance card of the set that I've been looking at is the Serac, the Hunt Caller. I don't know if you guys have looked over that one, the 4-mana 5/4. I think he's sitting at, like, I want to say, like, $2 right now. And
He is $149 pre-order on Card Kingdom, at least. That's what I'm looking
at. And part of what's holding him down is the I think he's going to be in the event deck or one of the pre-cons. But even with that, at that price, I've seen him in a lot of competitive lists. I've seen a lot of buzz talk about him, you know, and I can't imagine at $1.50 that he's a bad buy. I could easily see him going up to at least $4 or $5.
I could see this actually playing well in concert with, like, if any of the dragons pick up steam, playing this guy on 4 and then a dragon on 5, giving a haste attacking for, like, 10, being a mid-range strategy that I think a lot of decks will struggle with, because 5/4s and, you know, 5/5 flyers or 4/4 flyers aren't really easy to kill in Standard. There's not a lot of 4 damage burn spells, as far as I know, except for Stoke the Flames. Roast, and then there's not... Roast will kill Sarkin, actually. But there's not many Doomblade effects either. Like, Ultimate Price won't see much play, I don't think. So I think you'll see this guy turn some corners that we weren't expecting.
He's got a lot of applications that I've been seeing. I mean, for one, there's an artifact that I don't know how many of you guys are familiar with it, but I believe it's like Hero's Blade, and it can only equips for free to legendary creatures when they come into play. So he immediately triggers his own Formidable and becomes an 8/4 with haste, or an 8/6 rather. Mm-hmm. And then, like, even in just like a regular Abzan shell, he seems pretty good at the 4 spot alongside a Siege Rhino.
I like him with the Hornet Queen coming in there and you just buzz around with 6 power worth of flyers.
Mm-hmm. Right on. And then your last one.
So the last one is one you think is, like, overhyped then? Is that the case?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah, overhyped or just get rid of it.
Hmm. I'm trying to think what's even been being hyped in this set. It just seems like a lot of cards people think are kind of interesting.
I had the same issue, John, in looking at the pre-orders. If you go through the rares, there's not one rare that's more than, like, $4 pre-order, which is, you know, to be expected. A lot of the rares aren't even hitting more than, you know, $4 after they get played. But if you go into the mythics, like, they just have a tendency to be, you know, like, they have a tendency to have high pre-orders just merely on the fact that they're mythic cards.
Yeah, I think, if anything, I would say, I hate to hate on my own color over here, but I think the Dragon Whisperer card is good, but I think at $8, it's, like, incredibly overpriced right now. I think it's going to come down once people realize it's not that great.
Which one is that?
That's the one that's a 2-mana, 2/2. It's double red, and then you can pay a red, give it flying, or you can pay 2 mana to give it fire breathing. And it has a formidable where you can make dragons at 6 mana. I mean, it's a good card, but I think it's more of a $3-4 rare than an $8 rare, unless it just finds a home immediately that, you know, is pretty successful.
I mean, it'll just be a vanilla 2/2 with fire breathing. Like, I think a lot of people, the last kind of vanilla 2/2 like this we had comparison for was Kargan Dragonlord, and that card was way better than this card. Like, this card, I don't think we'll see as much play as Kargan Dragonlord did.
Daryl, I've heard that a lot, man. But what about Still Moon Cavalier? You remember that card? I think this reminds me more of that.
So First Strike is way, way better than flying. Being and having protection from removal. So Still Moon Cavalier, for those of you that weren't familiar with it, is a 1 and black-white hybrid, 2 of those, for a 2/1 pro-white, pro-black. And then you could pay, I think it's white-black hybrid. Let me look it up real quick.
Yeah, it is.
To give it flying or +1/+0, and then
it's one.
You can also give it. You can also give it. Yeah, 1 for flying or first strike. So being able to give it both of those abilities and take to the skies or cut down 3 or 4 toughness creatures, and have protection from the 2 biggest removal spells, because Stillmoon Cavalier shared a standard with Path to Exile and Doomblade and Terminate. Like, being able to ignore all of those cards and cut down larger creatures, all as a mana sink in the late game, is way better than this guy is. Because you're never going to, like, draw this guy in the late game and ferocious him and make a dragon. Like, that's not going to happen.
So, Still Moon Cavalier is still holding at, like, $7. I'm looking at Kingdom, probably lower on TCG, but...
Still Moon was a pretty incredible card, too. I don't think I would draw a comparison to Dragon Whisperer here. The Dragon Lord guy that you mentioned, Daryl, is kind of the direct comparison, but I think he's more important in this format just because he's an enabler. Red Devotion really hasn't had an archetype for a while. But unfortunately, I don't think he's going to slot in very easily with the really hyper red decks. And that's going to limit his potential to where he's going to go.
Sure.
He's also not something that I'm, like, ready to just immediately jam 4 of in every list. And that's going to hold his value down, too, I think.
So you don't think he's a 4 of in your deck?
I think he's only a 4 of in, like, a red devotion deck. And outside of that, he's probably more of a 1 of.
Okay. Yeah, I would compare him, if he were a 4 of, I'd compare him to maybe the pricing of Stromkirk Noble or that Satyr, the 1-drop Satyr. And,
oh, Firedrinker Satyr, yeah.
Yeah, and then maybe, you know, double the 1.5 its price, since it's a mythic rather than a rare. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's probably not quite worth $8.
So what do you think? $2 down the line? $3?
I think it could probably hold steady at about 4, because it's going to see play. I think it will see a decent amount of play, but I don't think it's an $8 card. So I wouldn't buy now, at least, but I'd wait a couple weeks. It should come down.
All right,
kill the Dragon Whisperer.
All right, kill it. Zhu Ming. Man, I'm going to get these pronunciations right soon. You know, it's funny. Someday. Brandon was my roommate. I still pronounce his name wrong.
Yeah, I still call you Z-Stick.
All right, Zhu Ming. Sorry. Go on, man.
All right. So for Mary, Death Mist Raptor looks hot to me. I've seen lots of people testing out this card, and it looks very, very solid, especially in a shell like Green-White Devotion. I can see this card doing a lot of work. Even though my standard knowledge is very limited, from what I've seen from this card, it looks like it could be a powerhouse. What do you guys think?
What's that standard deck that was running around and ruined the GP because it went to overtime?
The life gain deck.
Yeah.
Green White Devotion with Mastery DMC. Yeah, this card slots perfectly into it as, I think, as a mirror kind of draw, because, like, you're going to be getting a free creature because you're turning creatures face up. But a 3-3 Death Toucher that became a 4-4 Death Toucher, if you're not playing, like, Annihilia to give it trample so it can, like, walk through your opponent's creatures and things like that, you're not really getting too much out of it. Like, it's really good as, like, an annoying recursive threat against control because you'll, like, unmorph your elf and get a Death Mist Raptor.
Yeah. He has two green symbols in his cost, so that helps.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it helps Devotion, but largely what I've been hearing so far is that they think he's going to go in a more of an aggressive shell rather than the Devotion deck. But I do like what you were saying, Daryl, about his ability to kind of punch through a walled up state. But I think one of the problems is that Green White Devotion usually has so many permanents on the board that I wonder how important that is for a 3-3 with Death Touch to get through.
Yeah.
How much is he worth right now? Does anyone know?
He's sitting at $15 right now.
Oh,
so the hype is there, and the hype is being created.
I don't think I'd marry him for $15.
Of course, this price is inflated due to the pre-release price, and he probably won't stay at $15. But I think there is reason to the hype, and he's going to be a contender in many standard decks, if not spawning new ones.
All right.
Okay.
As for finance, again, I don't know much about the standard metagame, so I like to look at longer-term specs, especially for ADH, because that's where a lot of money can be made these days, especially Mythic. So I see Mr. 6-mana Make-A-Bunch-Dragons Mythic at foil sitting around $3, and that seems like a good spec to me.
Oh, what's the name of this card?
Yeah, which card are we talking about?
Let's see. Descent of the Dragons. Descent of the Dragons. This card is very exciting for EDH. Obviously, the most applicable way to use it is to put it into a token deck, destroy all your 1/1s, and make a bunch of 4/4s. Even a deck like Purphoros, where you make a bunch of tokens, you could just destroy all of them and make a bunch of dragons. That also goes into that deck. It actually seems like this price has gone up since I last looked at it, when it was around $3. Looks like foil copies are being bought out, but cards like this with a lot of EDH impact that are mythic and from a third set, I like to keep an eye on because there's a lot of room for growth, and especially since it makes dragons, and casuals love dragons.
All right.
And then my last pick for kill is Myth Realized, because I do not think that card is very good, and people are saying it is the card printed for Eternal formats in the set, and I strongly disagree. I think that it's not Delver of Secrets, it's not Monastery Mentor, it's not Swift Spear. I think it's a trap. I think on the surface it looks like it could be insane, but in the end you're just going to be dumping a bunch of resources to something that gets Swords of Plowshares or Abrupt Decay or whatever.
I'm curious, because I thought you guys were pretty high on that card initially. What changed your mind on it?
I don't know. I actually did some testing with a friend, and he tried it out in some existing decks, and it turns out that it's just really weak to Abrupt Decay and Swords of Plowshares. But
isn't Delver 2?
It's over 1 mana.
Right. So it's not going to – I don't think it's better than Delver, and it's not better than any of the other one-drop creatures that Delver is currently using. So why play it? There's no reason to play it, especially since you have to commit mana to it to actually get it to do some damage.
One mana.
There are arguments for, it avoids Terminus, yada, yada, yada. But it's not doing damage to the Miracle player, so – I don't think they should care about it.
How about standard? Do you see like a kind of a blue-white tempo type of deck being built?
potentially for Standard, this card could be played in something like you said, like a blue white temple shell, but I think all the Eternal hype that it's getting is very, very incorrect. Because people are saying you can build around this card, you know, you could make a Monastery Mentor deck, and I just think that's completely false.
I've seen it a little bit in Standard, too, and I've been playtesting, and, like, I was, like, fairly impressed. I definitely thought it was a worse card initially when I first glanced at it. I could certainly see what you're saying, Shuming, about how Legacy, it just... it isn't applicable because there's enough answers and you're investing too much. But I think in Standard, I see it kind of like, I'm trying to think of the other white enchantment that's been really popular recently. Mastery of the Unseen.
Mastery of the Unseen.
Yeah, where you just get a lot of very small incremental value, a very helpful card in the late game that you really don't have to invest in Standard as much as you would in Legacy.
Right, absolutely. And in Standard, once you make it into a dude, it's harder to remove than in Modern and Legacy. So
all right. That's an argument for it there. So I'm going to jump in and take the reins here because my Mary is actually Mythrealized. So I think the Shuming is completely wrong. So
right, go for it.
As far as Standard is concerned, this is like a very plausible win condition in your control decks and in some, like, heroic decks, if they're going to be playing, like, one guy, spell, you have another guy sitting on the table. So if you have some downtime, you can just invest it in putting Mythrealize into play. And then you can untap, play a spell, it gets a counter, play a spell, it gets a counter, and slowly you just have this counter machine building up, and you're like, oh, I have a mana, attack you for 8. Because they're going to have to burn their removal on the things you're playing. And in the control decks that would be playing this, you're just going to go spell, end hostilities, activate, attack you for 5. And that's going to be a completely legitimate win con. Like, you're going to have to, like, keep counter magic, obviously, because people are just going to kill creatures. So I see it potentially, it could be a win con, or it could just be a sideboard card for the control mirrors. Because people will board out their removal, and then you play the, well, how much removal are you boarding out? How many enchant removal spells are you boarding out? You play that game. But I see, like, it being very good and constructed in Eternal formats. Because you're saying, oh, they have Swords of Plowshares and Abrupt Decay. Well, they only have so many of those. You put Mythrealized into play along in a Delver deck somewhere along the way. Then you're dazing them, you're taxing probing, you're pondering, you're going to make this guy like a 3-3 or a 4-4. And that's perfectly big enough to just, like, all right, attack you with some dice. Okay, you Terminist. All right, activate my enchantment. Attack you for 4. Oh, you don't have it? Okay, attack you for 4 again. Keep doing this, and, like, then you can hold on to any Delvers you draw, or Stone Fortress 6, or Monastery for Spears, whatever flavor of Delver you're playing. You can hold on to your Tarmogoyfs and your Bobs if you make a Delver deck in that vein, and you can just attack them. And just be like, here's a guy, attack.
Yeah, but what are you taking out of a Delver deck to get this card in there, though? I mean, we're talking about very valuable cards in Legacy here.
Yeah, that's the problem. I'm kind of like, no, you don't get rid of lands, unfortunately. No. Like, I just kind of, like, shaved on some of the, like, clunkier threats. Like, I look at this as, like, a little bit better of a Monastery Mentor in those decks that were playing it, and, like, the mid-range decks, because, or in the Delverish decks that were trying to play that card, because you're not going to get to 3 mana most of the time with your Delver deck unless you're losing. So this slots in as another one drop that you can play, and the spells that you're gaining incremental advantage off of, your Stifles and your Wastelands and your Dazes, and those things that you're gaining that little bit of advantage off of already, you're making a 4-3-3, a 4-4. So
I think the Mentor comparison is not a very good one, because I don't think there's any real good Delver decks out there that are playing Mentor. I mean, people might have tried it, but that seems like a terrible idea for Delver.
Right. We haven't seen any results with Monastery Mentor yet.
And we've seen a couple of decks, like, crest into the top 16. We haven't seen a deck, like, break through. That's probably on Breakers. So, I mean, there's a theory there, that sure. But I feel like this card has a lot of potential for in shells. I think that Modern will be its best home, because Modern is the format that wants to build a tempo-y deck that's like Remand and Spell Pierce and Spell Snare, but Delver's terrible in Modern because you can't set it up.
Alright, what's your finance, man?
Finance is actually, like, you're not going to see the needle move on this card, these cards a lot, but right, all of the shrines, the uncommon 3-mana or monuments, sorry, all the uncommon 2-mana color producing shrines that turn into 4-4 dragons or 5-5 dragons, I can't remember which one it is, they're just
talking about the mana rocks, right?
Yeah, the mana rocks that turn into dragons. They're just very solid cards. Like, there are decks in Standard that will want mana ramp, and then your mana ramp eventually turns. It's just like a man land. It turns into a 4/4 or a 5/5. So you have this like late game mana sink that you can activate and attack with. And I can see like the green devotion decks, if they need a mana source, okay, sure, I'll put this into play and I have a dragon sitting around if I need it. You know, in some control decks, you'll definitely want these as like, here's a mana ramp to get to my End Hostilities on turn 4 and then untap and play Elspeth on 5. And then if you kill my Elspeth, I can turn this on and start 4-ing you to death. And then I'm sure there will be some sort of ramp. You can start to build like ramp strategies. These kind of flow well into the dragons themselves. So it kind of, I think it gives you a little flexibility as far as what you can do without, you don't have to commit your L's and Sylvan Chariots to the board, and then you get board wiped and you're down to 3. You can have a couple of these lying around and say, all right, I'm still a 5, land for 6, another dragon. So if there can be this sort of ramp deck that starts to build a payoff, with these things also being payoff cards.
Yeah, remind me of the Key Runes or something.
Yeah.
These are a lot better than the Key Runes, though. I mean, Daryl, I completely agree with you on these cards. It was one of the first things in the spoiler that really stood out to me. I'm curious, from a finance angle, though, why do you think these are going to go up in price being at uncommon?
I think they'll just peak as, like, dollar uncommons, and they'll definitely be, like, EDH playable. Any deck that you're playing, like, a Talisman, or in some decks in Azori Signet, you know, picking up the free roll of making a 4-4 dragon off of it is fine. I just think they'll kind of tick up from, you know, what standard uncommons to that is, you know, 4 to 50 cents. I think they'll see enough play to ratchet them up to a dollar, and they'll sit at like a $1 to $1.50 uncommon range. I don't think it's like buy them and then you're going to offload them at $3, $4, $5, though. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think you'll see this sit much higher than the regular uncommon that will see less play.
Daryl, what are you going to kill?
Narset. Dead. It's dead to me. So I saw it, and I've heard people mention the J word, mentioned Jace the Mind Sculptor, and I think people are not correct. This card will be just fine for Standard. It's just this big, derpy planeswalker that can protect itself, kind of, because you have to have spells to go along with it. You just play
it off with its big butt. That's what it does.
Yeah, I mean, the loyalty is ridiculous at 6, going into 7.
It is big at 6 or 7, but, like, you're taking a turn off, and your aggro opponent's just going to ignore this thing. Like, you're saying on turn 3, instead of playing an interactive spell with your opponent, or playing a Jace Architect of Thought and lessening the blow that your opponent's going to cast, you're going to take a turn off on turn 4, maybe draw a card, and play this card, and put it up to 7, and get hit in the face for, like, 8, and then maybe take a burn spell and end up dead.
Yeah,
like,
it's definitely not.
I don't think that's realistic for the best card in Standard. Like, Elspeth was like this card that we saw and we were like, oh, we don't know. Actually, this card's pretty good. And it just turned out if you could stay alive till you played Elspeth, the game was over. You just crushed your opponent under the weight of Elspeth. I don't think Narset is like that you'll stay alive and play Narset and then crush them under the weight of Narset. You have to draw the correct cards in order to make Narset go. As far as Jason Perrin's Elspeth is concerned, it just like, planeswalker, kill you.
Right, right.
So I think that Narset is the third best planeswalker in those two colors, behind Jace being number 1 because it's a card advantage and it keeps you alive to get you to Elspeth being number 2 because it kills them. I think it's a very good support planeswalker, but I would not play any copies of it before I maxed out on the other two.
There's no Tybalt, man. This is an EDH card, though. It's not $40, but somewhere down the line, I could see it being, like, you know, a $20 card. Anything that doubles or makes another copy of something, which I would consider Rebound to be doubling, right? This is something that's going to be played in EDH.
Right. That's a perfect environment for it, but yeah, like Daryl said, eternal formats, not so much.
No. I mean, eternally with this is, like, make a Bant deck in Modern and pair it with Time Warp and just be like, all right, I'm going to Rebound this Time Warp.
Absolutely. And another point to that, Daryl, and people are talking about it in Miracle Shells, and what that forces you to do is play all your instant speed cards on your turn, which makes them far worse, and I really dislike that.
That's one of the things
I really, really dislike.
Correct.
It's, I mean, maybe it's something that won't make an impact in Legacy, but I think besides just Standard, like Modern could see play for this card. I think it's a little stronger than you guys are giving it credit for. But, I mean, it's certainly one of those ones where you have to see if there's an existing shell, and then you also have to dig through the Gatherer and see if there's, you know, relevant spells you want to bring back to life because of this card. But, I mean, that loyalty is really high. You're just basically not attacking that card if you're playing aggro. And, you know, there are going to be those situations where you get them within burn range, but there's going to be plenty of situations on turn three or four where this card just comes down and you're not close to being at that stage yet. And I think in those situations, I mean, I don't see a way to beat this card very easily in a lot of aggro decks.
I mean, I'm not going to disagree with that.
But I still think that what Daryl said about Elspeth.
You mean in terms of which Elspeth are we talking about here?
Sun's Champion.
Like, I mean, I think we're different modes there, though. I mean, I think any deck that wants Narset, especially in Standard, you're going to want Elspeth as well. I mean, we're at two different mana costs there. This is your turn four, turn five play the majority of the time.
I would still rather play Architect of Thought. Like when Architect of Thought rotates out, Narset will just fill that slot because the blue decks need a four mana card.
Wait, which Architect of Thought?
Jace. Oh, that's no longer legal.
Yeah, it's standard. Not standard. Like, yeah. Why would the only Jace right now is the bad Jace.
So this will fill that slot that people would put Jace Architect of Thought in. So there's nothing to fill that slot, so it'll go up. But
like,
so
it's going to be bad against like the hyper aggro decks. But I think that, you know, we'll have to see if those decks are even competitive enough to be a tier one deck.
Sure.
All right, man. Can we move on from that one?
Sure.
All right. I'm gonna make mine quick here. My Mary was gonna be the what do you call that thing? The one that Daryl said, the white card.
Myth realized.
Yep. I switched it over though. I still agree that is a decent card. I think it's a real deal, and I think $4 is the right price for it. But I also think that $3 is the right price for Silumgar's Command. People have been hating on this one, and it costs 5 mana. It's the most expensive command out there. But I think it does everything you want it to do, and it's an instant speed card. And it's like every mode on this one, I'll read them real quick just for reference since there are four. Counter target non-creature spell, return a permanent to its owner's hand. Target creature gets -3/-3, or destroy target planeswalker. It's like every one of those is relevant. It does just about anything you'd want it to do, where worst-case scenario, returning a permanent to its owner's hand is like your only out. But the fact that mode is on there, it's like if you need to counter your creature spell and you don't have a target for the other one, right, like which is going to be commonly the case when you don't have a creature to hit or a planeswalker to hit, bouncing a permanent is just fine if that's sending land back to their hand or even one of your creatures for another comes into play ability. I don't know. I can see this one going in a black-blue control deck.
So that's your Mary?
That's my Mary. Yeah,
how much,
I'm getting
how much is Silly's Command?
It is $3. I'm looking at Card Kingdom prices. I don't know what it is on like TCG. I'm sure you can get it for less than that, like $2. I could see this card being $2 somewhere down the line. I think that's totally fair for it. I think it's right.
I could see it as $5 if you get an Esper control deck. And this is kind of the cornerstone fight for it.
Yeah. Cool. I think we just got Rickrolled. What was that?
Alright, so that's a quick wedding in Vegas.
Corey. Yeah, quick wedding. Alright, I'll keep my F really short. Oh, that's finance. Okay, I was confused. My finance is, there's only actually one card that I can think of that even has room to go up, and looking at the mythics, they're all pretty high. Like I said, they start high, and they always do. But Risen Executioner is $2 right now, and that seems crazy to me, because this card is like, this is like the casual's dream card, if you ask me. Like, the fact that it is a like relatively fairly costly creature with a lord type of ability on it tells me that somewhere down the line someone that's building a zombie deck is going to want this card, and they're going to be willing to pay more than $2 for it because it's a mythic card. Beyond that, I think it has potential to be played in like a control deck, right? People have talked about this being like your one like win condition, maybe in the sideboard in a mirror match or something.
I just step away for a minute. Which target card are we talking about?
I'm talking about Risen Executioner. That's the zombie guy that you can play from your yard.
That is not something I considered. This card actually looks a lot better now that you say that.
That card definitely looks like it'd be worth way more than $2.
It's kind of an anomaly, because if you look at the card, it's like it wants you to have other zombies in play, right? Because it gives them +1/+1. But at the same time, it's like it also wants to be the only creature card in your entire deck, you know?
Just the only card in your graveyard.
Only card in play, only card in your graveyard, right? So
it's kind of delves... Dull Strategies will appreciate this. You can also pair this with Empty the Pits to make a large army and Alpha Strike them. That's a thing that can happen. So,
yeah. Wait, so what format do you think this is going to be good in?
Standard, it can see some play. I don't know if it'll see a lot. And then it's a very good casual card, like EDH card.
That's where I was going with that one, yeah.
I think it's a commander card, yeah.
I can't get cheaper than $2. I mean, okay, yeah, it can go down to like $1.50 or something. I think it will. But by the time this set rotates out and somewhere down the line, it's definitely going to be worth $3 at the very minimum, probably $5.
I could see $5 in like 3 years from now.
All right, so then moving on, I got one more. It's my kill, and I'm going to kill Shore Crasher Elemental because I think it's stupid. I think people are all hyped up about the blue Devotion, and for some reason people think that we have to go back to blue Devotion, but I really don't think that deck is even good anymore. Best thing you can do with that, is the Master of the Waves, right? And with the amount of Bioblight and Drowning Sorrow that's running around, that seems like pretty awful. This guy right here has 3 blue pips on him, which is the most alluring aspect of him, right? And then he's got some, like, pseudo-morphling abilities. But how many pips does he have when you exile him and then return him to the battlefield face down? 0, until you pay 5 mana to megamorph the stupid thing.
I am going to have to disagree strongly on this one with you here. I've played with and against it, and I was watching Todd Anderson and Brad Nelson's Versus video the other day, and I think this card is really impressive. I think most of the time you're playing it, you're either going to have mana up to blink it. We all know how powerful Morphling was back in the day and similar kind of cards. And I agree Master of Waves may not be that good in this format because of the amount of removal we have access to right now. But I think there's still a pretty strong blue shell there because Icefall Regent kind of goes well along with these cards. You've got the new Stratus Dancer who's kind of a pseudo-negate. So I think there's actually a shell there that could come back here. If anything, I think it's got a better chance than like a red Devotion deck of coming back.
All right. I can see it with the God, with Thassa. You know, like if you can give this guy unblockable and get him for, 5 damage, I think that's pretty good. But it's just so mana intensive. And I mean, obviously, like the only thing you can do with it is like a mono blue deck unless you've got like modern mana fixing or legacy mana fixing.
You're probably going to be limited to that archetype, but I think it may single-handedly bring that back. And I think Thassa is really the major part of it because a 5-5 where you can make any of your creatures unblockable, I mean, that's still really difficult to stop that in Standard.
Right.
And you get to scry every turn. I don't know. What do the rest of you guys think? I'm curious about thoughts on this card, too.
All right, I guess I'll go. I'm with Corey on this one. I think people are having flashbacks of Aetherling doing absolutely crazy things in Standard and shaking up the metagame, but I honestly just think it's too mana intensive. Like Corey said, it's going to come back face down. You're going to have to pay 5 mana to flip it back over, and it's just going to do a whole lot of nothing when it's face down.
Yeah, that's my exact thought. My first thought was like to the waning days of I have a 5-5 unblockable, and then it's like, wait a minute. So I bring this guy back, and I have a 2-2 morph, and they, like, wild slash it, and I just go, and I pick my 2-2 morph up, and I put it in the graveyard, and I move on with my day, because I'm sad. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't see this. I see it potentially making a splash as, like, this could be a good control mirror card, because you can blink it, and then they can try and kill it, and at 6 mana, you can, like, flip it up. So, like, you can get it into play with 4 mana, have a blink, 5 mana, you can flip it up, and if they don't kill it on 5, then you can bring it, flip it up on 6 and blink it.
4 blue mana, remember, too. 4 blue mana.
Yeah, I mean, Control decks, I don't think will struggle with that. You have eight dual lands, 4 flooded strands. Like, if you can't put together 4 islands and 2 white sources, then you might have misspelled your mana base.
All right, so can we, should we conclude the MFK portion of the evening?
I mean, did we get Brandon into this, or?
Oh my god, Brandon! How do we get... You're up. Brandy, no fetch brainstorm, Semerau.
You gotta save the heavy hitters for last, man. Alright, Mary, I am in love with, I think, is that Dragonlord's prerogative? Jutai's prerogative?
Dragonlord's.
The 6 mana draw 4?
Draw 4.
Yeah,
as an additional cost, you can reveal a dragon card from your hand.
Or if you control one, yeah.
Or if you control one, it's uncounterable. I remember control decks back during Sphinx's Rev days. and the whole battle was decided upon who can start resolving what's the three mana X? Sphinxes.
Sphinxes Revelation.
It's a battle over Sphinxes. Well, now you're going to have Dragonlord's Prerogative, and there's not going to be a battle over it. You're just going to get it.
Yeah, you're just going to have a Slumdog Millionaire play this card, and point at it, and then draw four cards.
Yeah. So, at 36 cents, I might just buy like 12 of these, 24 of these.
Try and make it a dollar card and flip them?
80 of these. Yeah, sure. Why not?
This is also your finance card, then.
Yes.
I'm going to marry it and finance it.
You're going to M it before you F it, though, right? That's the way you're supposed to think.
Yeah, you got to do that.
And then kill. Let's be quick. Look, I think Standard is at an all-time low as far as the value of its cards. I mean, Siege Rhino has topped at 8. I've seen it vary from card store to card store between like 3 and 5. I just don't think it's a wise time to invest in a Standard card, hoping it's going to go up, unless it's Dragonlord's Prerogative. So kill. We know Modern Masters 2 is coming out. If you have any Mox Opals, I'd kill them. Sell them right now. You're probably going to get, you know, 40 to 50 bucks on it. They're going to reprint it because they're going to have Metalcraft and Modern Masters 2. And you're going to get them for 20 to 30 bucks a pop.
Not even related to the set.
Segment, Brandon. Okay.
Well, I'm curious about that, though, Brandon, because, I mean, we are talking finance here. And, you know, the last Modern Masters set, it seemed like a lot of the cards, you know, initially dropped in value, but then went back up to either their same amounts or higher. I mean, most noticeably with Tarmogoyf, so maybe that's a bad example. But why do you think that, you know, Opal is going to see a pretty insignificant print run if it gets reprinted?
Well, I think they're going to have a significant print run with Modern Masters too. Modern Masters 1 was an experiment. They said they were overly cautious with Modern Masters 1. They didn't say anything about that for 2015. They're reprinting Tarmogoyf, which means they don't care as much about the secondary market retaining its value.
So yeah, I think they said there was going to be a Tarmogoyf in every pack, I think, too.
Yeah, that's going to replace the basic landslide.
I mean, isn't it like 10 bucks a pack for the new ones, too, though?
It's a dollar more than it was 2 years ago.
Brandon, to go off of what you were saying, they actually have confirmed that it will be a limited print run, but all they've said was it will be a limited print run, but there will be more than Modern Masters 1. That's all they've said.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, the Commander packs are limited print runs. And there's plenty of those.
But a lot more people want Modern Master packs than Commander packs, so keep that
as true. I'm just taking, you know what, sometimes...
The Commander packs were... I mean, the Commander packs were also... There was more print runs that were done after the initial one. I mean, the initial one was in quite a bit of demand.
Right, and then they kept printing them into oblivion.
I mean, I could see, you know, cards losing value. I mean, there certainly was some, like, modern staples that lost value initially the first time around. I'm just concerned about, like, what I saw with Goyf, where that card has just become obscene at this point, and it seems like the first Modern Masters didn't make a dent. But Mox Opal may not fall under that category since it's not as chased after.
Yeah, it's basically an affinity.
Tarmogoyf has this aura around it that, since it's so big and so green and just 2 mana, it's got to be so expensive. And I think it's just a Tarmogoyf thing, honestly. People just have this thing about Tarmogoyf that they can't get over.
So that dates back to when it was released. That was just the first card that was like, that card at release was $2. Nobody thought it was good. And it was just $2, and it was $2, and it was $2. And then, like, some pros were like, this card's bonkers, let's play it. And it skyrocketed to, like, $40 overnight. And then it went to $50, and then it went to $60, and then it went to $80, and then it made it to $100. And everyone was like, it's a $100 card standard, what's going on? And so, in Tarmogoyf, it was just kind of that card that kicked off, I think, like, if you look at the Magic Finance bubble, Tarmogoyf was the card that rose the tide for all of us. And so people people just associate Tarmogoyf with this card that you just have an ever-inflating price, and then that creates the spec bubble of like things like Narset. We don't want to miss the next one.
Absolutely, Daryl. And a lot of people have that, you know, magical card that they're chasing after that will be the next big spike. And that's part of Tarmogoyf's price, I think. It's just the aura that surrounds it of hype.
All right. I think we've killed this finance and whole thing section.
MFK. Yeah.
Shall we move on to tournaments?
We should.
Yep.
All right.
Since there are no tournaments, no SCGO, no GPs or any of that this weekend, we will talk quick pre-release experience and predictions for playing Constructed, which we kind of covered in our MFK segment. But we kind of want to tie this in now more to the state of the meta in Standard and Modern and in Legacy and things like that. I went to the pre-release. Did you guys all go?
I did a couple of 2HGs, so my perspective is a little skewed.
Yeah.
All right. I did not get a chance. I was in Omaha watching the March Madness.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I was also March Madnessizing.
Cool. Well, I had a good time, man. The set's pretty cool. I like going back to two colors now, and it seems like it's easier to build a deck without having to go into four colors with really crappy mana fixing. But there's, like, almost no mana fixing in this set. There's, like, Terramorphic Expanse or whatever you call it, Evolving Wilds, whichever one it is. I didn't end up with a Narset, but I did end up with a Narset token, and so I sleeved it up and I put it on the side of my blue-white deck, and anytime I took my deck out of the box, I just, like, kind of set it down on the table and sort of, like, sort half sneak it behind my box to make it look like I was hiding it. There are a couple of guys that asked me straight out, they're like, oh, man, did you actually get a Narset? And I couldn't just lie to their face. I had to say it. No, man. I was just trying to psych you out. But there are a couple of dudes that were holding back removal the entire game because I thought I had it in my deck. Which in Limited would just be like almost an auto win, right? If you can't answer it. Maybe not. Maybe
no,
not.
No, I can't see you losing with that card in Limited. That seems pretty bananas.
So, that was fun. I ended up playing blue, black, and white and splashing for that guy from the last set. That's 5-mana, 5/4 flyer that kills all their creatures except for two. At the end of the turn, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
Depravity. Archfiend of Depravity.
Yeah, the bugdest mono card ever.
Yeah, that guy was pretty awesome in that deck. So. Quick thought on Megamorph. I had two Stratus Dancers in my deck. That was one of my pre-release cards. And I really liked those cards in Limited. I thought they were pretty awesome. But the whole Megamorph thing, like, I feel like in Standard Constructed, you invest so much mana into it, and you put yourself so far behind, when you have a creature that one removal spell can just take out, and you've already sunk, like, okay, in that case, 5 mana into it. All right, now that guy's not an example because he can counter the removal spell, but in just about any other case, it's like, if you're not playing in a format and in a meta, like Limited, Sealed is, where everybody else is playing Megamorph too, I feel like any of those cards are just so freaking slow.
Absolutely agree.
They are.
I think there's a little differentiation here, though. I think that on paper it looks like such a slow ability, but I think there's a couple of cards that we'll probably see play with the ability. You mentioned yourself how, like, the Stratus Dancer protects himself from removal. His Megamorph cost isn't that much of an investment. It's only 2 mana. There's a guy in red. I don't know if you guys saw this guy, Ire Shaman. He's a 2-drop that's already pretty playable because he has to be blocked by at least 2 or more creatures, and his Megamorph cost is only 1 red, and when you unmorph him, it lets you do basically the Chandra Exile ability until end of turn. So, like, I think cards like that where it's efficient are going to see play, but I agree with you on the 4 and 5 mana Megamorphs. I think that's only going to be in a deck that either wants to get cute or has a real purpose for playing it.
It's not the Megamorph cost that turns me off. It's the Morph cost. It's like having to pay 3 for the 2/2 in the first place. It's like you play that on turn 3, right? And someone's got just about any piece of removal can kill that thing, right? So technically, like, that Stratus Dancer, which is a fine card, I would say, because people are already playing those 2/1 flyers back in those blue mono-blue devotion decks. Cloud Fin Raptor. Yeah, so that guy's fine for 2 mana, but I wouldn't play him then for 3 more turns if I missed that opportunity, you know, because I want him to be able to protect himself.
So, what I think about these cards is that if you end up with a deck that you're playing Mastery of the Unseen with, these cards will slot fine into those decks, because, you know, if they have reasonable bodies. Like, the one that, like, kind of jumps off the page is what she means, like, Deathless Raptor. Like, that card, it's fine. You can unmorph it for three with Master of the Unseen, because it has Manifest, and that's fine. You can un-Megamorph it. I think, I don't know how Manifest works, because I don't play Standard a lot, but I would assume you could un-Megamorph it as well, which would then make it a 4-4. I mean,
yep, like, you can, yep.
Okay, so cards with Megamorph that kind of fit into the Master of the Unseen deck will be good. All the rest of them, I don't think we'll see a lot of constructive play because of all of the mana you have to invest to get very little back.
I mean, the bodies on some of these, I think especially if we look at the ones that are part of that two-mana cycle, those are the ones that I really see seeing the most play.
Yeah.
Like the Ire Shaman, the Slumgar Assassin, the Stratus Dancer, the Hidden Dragon Slayer.
Yeah.
I think those ones are efficient on their own just as a creature.
Sure. And so, you know, you're not like, those are Shriek Maw. Right.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing the Megamorph costs, like, or you're playing as a morph really only when you have nothing else to do on that turn, so it's not like you're forced into that role that often.
Shriekmaw is the opposite, though, Brandon. It's like, these guys are like, you either get a creature that's not so useful to you, or you get this relevant ability for more mana, whereas Shriekmaw is like, you either get that relevant ability or the creature.
Or both. Yeah, you get...
Almost, I don't know.
But you get the relevant ability, or
right,
both.
Right, okay, I understand. Yeah, for more mana, you get both.
So you get a crappy creature or a crappy creature plus relevant ability.
Right, right. So the first part is the choice part, and I would rather have Shriekmaw in that case. Not to say that these guys are bad. I don't know what to think about them. Do you think any, like, is any one of them going to see have a better chance to see play in Standard or what?
Yeah, I mean, I look at those five and, like, look at the first abilities on all of them. So you got a 2-mana 2/1 lifelink. You got a 2-mana 2/1 flying. You have a guy that's in black. Creatures of power greater than him can't block him. The other guy can't block unless two or more creatures block him. And then the other guy's power less than him can't block him. So, I mean, I think all of those guys are suitable grizzly bears right off the bat. All of their Megamorph costs are reasonable, and then they all have a very relevant bonus ability if you do unmorph them. Yeah. And, like, I think that's what will push those guys. The other Megamorphs, like, I could see them seeing basically get no play. The only card I like outside of it really is the one that we kind of all are on either side of the fence, and that's that Shore Crasher Elemental. But, you know, other than that, like, the rest of the Megamorphs just look pretty bad to me.
So where do they go, though? I mean, meta considerations, like...
So what I've seen so far, like Craig Wesco, I know, was slotting, I think he had some of the Hidden Dragon Slayer, that's the white one, in some, you know, white aggressive decks, because basically it can deal with, you know, a Siege Rhino or, you know, something like that, and as a 2-1 lifelink body, it's not terrible either.
Yeah. Can you remind me what that one does?
It's a 2-1 lifelink, Megamorphs for 3, and when it's turned face up, you destroy target creature with power 4 or greater in opponent controls. So, you know, I could see, like, on turn 3, if you have really nothing better to do, you're playing this, or later in the game you're playing this, and then the next turn or that same turn, you're flipping it up to kill their best guy.
And that's right on tempo, too. You're not going to want to hit that 4 mana or 4 power creature on turn 2 or on turn 3 anyway, because they're not going to exist.
Right, and I think a lot of these aggro decks, you know, usually in an aggro deck, you're not overloading on the 3-drop spot, so a lot of times you just will have a bunch of 2-drops in your hand, and on turn 3, to be efficient, I'd most of the time rather just play this guy for his morph cost, and then the next turn I could decide whether I want to unmorph it or just play 2 more 2-drops.
Right. Yeah, I think the ones that are doing, you know, the Chandra ability, the kill a guy, and the ones that have that invasion, the red one and the black one and the green one, I think all those will see play. I think the negate guy can see play, but I don't think he'll see a lot of play. But I think that efficient cycle will be the only one, and then obviously the raptor.
Yep, I like dinosaurs. I don't know about that raptor. But we won't go into that.
Yeah, we've talked enough about that guy. So that guy, let him be a dinosaur somewhere else.
All right. Jurassic Park 3 is coming out. He might just be hyped up for, you know, the fanboys.
Sure.
He might want to build a raptor deck. Should we go on? Does anyone else have any pre-release stories to tell before we...
I played only 2HG. And so ground rule of 2HG is you look through your pool... You find anything that has the clause, each opponent, and then you basically just double its effect. So we played Impact Tremors, three of in our deck, and every time we landed an Impact Tremors, we won that match.
Okay, we're all searching this one out. Can you explain that one?
Yeah, so it's an enchantment. It's one red and a colorless, and it says whenever a creature enters the battlefield under your control, Impact Tremors deals one damage to each opponent. So,
oh yeah,
it's Purphoros's ability.
Ding.
But it's just the front end of Purphoros, and it's only a common. And granted, we're doing 2HG, but I think if somebody wanted to pursue maybe a Jeskai tokens strategy in standard, I think this would be a fine inclusion. It's a non-creature spell, Jeskai tokens. You're playing a lot of non-creature spells, so you can always loot away your extras if you want, if you're playing the actual Ascendancy itself. So I see this as an enchantment that's probably actually going to see some standard play.
Yes, if you follow this up with Hordling Outburst, at worst it's a, you know, Lava Spire, what is it, Lightning Strike to their face, right?
Yeah, two mana. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it could get better.
Right. Obviously, it's better on turn two than anything later, but I see that as seeing some play.
Yeah. All right, cool. All right, so news, are we good with the pre-release? We talked a lot about the new set. It's very exciting.
Yeah, we beat a dead dragon quite a bit.
Yeah, we did.
I mean, there's so much to talk about in that set, too. I mean, I agree with you guys. I think it's probably best to move on, but at the same time, like, there's a lot of cards there that I think still have application.
Yeah, legit. And it's interesting. I'm interested to see how these unfold next week and how many of them show up in the new deck. I think in the new decks. I think that having this is a larger set, right? This is a bigger third set than we're used to, isn't it?
Yeah, they're trying to ease us into the large set, slightly smaller set rotation.
Okay. And so, yeah. So there's more to choose from, and typically that third set doesn't have a huge impact on the standard meta game right away, but I think this one might.
I think so as well.
Okay. Yep. All right, news. I want to talk Puka for a bit because I got into Puka trade per the suggestion of one of your friends, Brandon, actually, Alex
Bernstein. Alex Bernstein, absolutely. Yeah.
I was complaining about selling cards on TCG Player and, like, really losing out to fees and, like, putting out the low rates and just, like, I don't know, I was kind of getting screwed on there. So I did Puka trade, and I've had some pretty good experiences on it. I've got a lot of cards, but in, like, just a short tenure there, I've already had some issues that make me a little concerned about the whole system. And to explain Puka trade really fast, I'm sure you guys all know about that stuff, but basically you are credited points for sending cards to people who want them, and those points go up into an escrow account when you have clicked that you're committed to sending it to them. And so they're kind of floating in space for a while until they mark that they've received the card. And then once they've received the card, then the points go from the escrow account to your account as the sender. And so I got in and wanted to get rid of an extra spell scout. I had a third spell scout. So I figured it was like a good middle of the road card that wasn't worth too much money. That I wasn't too worried about, you know, losing if things went wrong. And things did go wrong because the guy claimed that he never received the card, and the 14 days went by and we opened the case and everything. Customer service was, like, really slow to intervene and, like, really kind of sort things out. But this guy basically was really pushy, and he was really pushy from the get-go, which made me concerned about sending it to him. He was really bugging me about it being near mint, which I get. But then he said something like, how did you mark the sent on a Sunday? There's no post on Sunday. I put it in a mailbox, whatever. And then followed that up with, if it doesn't arrive in 4 days, I'm going to cancel the trade. And I was like, okay, fine, dude. You're going to have to send it back in that case. But it turns out that after customer service finally intervened on the situation, it was like they had given him a warning in our like chat between the two of us that was something along the lines of, you have had 60 open cases against you in the last month, and so this is a warning that this cannot happen again for this guy.
Wow.
Does that not seem like a red flag to you? 60 open cases in 1 month. I haven't made that many trades in my life on Puka Trade.
Corey, can I steal your thunder for a minute?
Yes, please steal my thunder. I want an explanation on this whole thing.
Okay, so I've been dipping into Magic Finance a little bit more because I live in a place where I can't play. So if you can't play, you do the next best thing, which is buy and sell. And so I was selling my cards on eBay, and I used to do this 3 years ago. And then I stopped because I had other things going on. And now that I've started doing that again, I had a bunch of modern cards that I assume were going to be reprinted in MM 2015. And so I put them up and I sold them. And there were about 10 orders, 10 batches that went through. And out of those 10 batches, I had two people state that they lost their package. All right, so that's 20%.
Yeah.
That are lost in the mail. And now I did one more order that I sent, which was a booster box. All right, I did Walgreens had a buy two, get one free, or buy one, get one free booster pack deal. So I basically bought half a box, got the rest of the half a box for free, sold it on eBay. I sent it with tracking, and the guy stated that he never got his box, but I didn't send him the tracking number. And so after he stated that he didn't get his box, I went to FedEx, and I looked it up, and sure enough, it was stated as delivered and received. Right. So.
Oh, man. And so I should have done that. I didn't send tracking on my order.
It costs so much. It costs
away from the money that you're making on it, right? Yeah. So there's a point where it's like with tracking and everything, it's not even worth sending the card. It's like you just got to go find someone at a shop that wants to trade for it.
Yeah, like if you're shipping dual lands, if you're moving tabernacles, if you're like selling actual like $300-$500 cards, yeah, track it so that everyone gets what they want. But like when you're dealing in tens and twenties, it's kind of hard to justify the tracking costs.
25 is my cutoff. I'll put tracking on a $25 order or $25 trade. So, I mean, is it, like, my question to you is 60 unopened cases. This guy looks like a shop on Puka, right? Is that not, like, does it seem like he is receiving cards, not marking complete, and eventually he gets those points back from escrow, I would assume? Or if a case is open, he's getting those points back. Why aren't they picking up on that? Why aren't they putting him in under investigation, you know? That might have something to do with it.
We live in a society where these online businesses value the customer more than the seller.
Right. And that's exactly what I was going to say. For sites like eBay, they have a buyer protection program that is far more strict than their seller protection program, because the person giving the other person the money is always going to be treated better and always valued more by these companies.
I assume Puga is probably a little less less controlled as well than some of these other outlets, because I don't use it, but I have a friend who uses it a lot. And he was talking about how, like, he'll ship cards, I don't know if it's internationally or just very far away, and, like, you know, say that, you know, it's up to your responsibility whether they get there or not, and the people will pay him, and then he just won't even ship the cards. Like, it's super shady, but, like, he gets away with it a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's just because that's Puka and they don't have the resources to really deal with these kind of things. Because, I mean, what you're describing, like 60 flag cases, that sounds just absurd.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure if I need to be concerned about that. Like, I got my points back after fighting. And that was really the only situation I've had besides, like, some slow trades. And, I mean, these guys are obviously working really hard to make this a viable source of, like, trading over the internet. And there are some features that are yet to be added. Like, one thing that's going to really help is having, like, user reviews and user feedback. And if you've got bad feedback, that, like, I'm not going to trade with you. You know, I'm not going to send you a card. You know? And that's something that's not in place yet. Though I very much wish it was.
I don't know if that's too helpful, though. I got bad feedback for the three guys who claimed they didn't receive my packages, and now my eBay account is basically unusable.
Oh, so you got bad feedback for it.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
So I guess that's the death toll on eBay, too. I mean, like, no one wants to buy from somebody who has any kind of bad feedback on eBay just because you have a million other people you can buy from, and it's just not necessary. And especially as, like, a small-time seller. Like, I used to sell a decent amount on eBay, but, like, it takes forever to get to the high vaunted areas where, like, a tick of a star doesn't make a difference for you. And even then, like, big companies seem to fight you tooth and nail over it.
So what's the solution, Schumann?
The solution is to buy and sell high-end cards on the Facebook Magic page, honestly. If you're selling expensive cards, you just want to sell on Facebook now because you pay actually, you don't pay any fees because you're always going to sell at a better price than you could on eBay, and you're going to buy at a better price than you could on eBay. The only downside is that not everyone likes that community. So you have to deal with that community if you want to buy and sell there. But in my experience, it's been very safe. And if you buy and sell from people with very high rep and that are well known throughout the community, you're always getting a better deal, and you're always selling at a better price, and you're never going to get screwed over. I've probably sold to over 50 people on that page without any sort of problems whatsoever.
Well, it's also $50 plus on there.
Right, right.
That's the limit. You have to post a $50 card or more. I mean, $20 cards, like, what do you go to TCG Player with those? Is that worthwhile? That's what I've been doing for a long time. I don't know if I'm really making out ahead. I think I'm just losing money there.
Honestly, with any card, $40, $50 below that, I try to trade up into higher value and then sell it like that. Okay. I don't even think it's worth selling, because when you sell and get paid through PayPal, they take a flat fee every time. So if you sell like a bunch of $10 cards, you're losing out on a lot of money, because they're taking a flat fee out of every one of those orders that you're selling. And that's just eBay has monopolized the market, unfortunately. So that's just what people have to use. So
yeah, that's pretty much why I stopped selling on there too.
Absolutely. So the best way to avoid it is to trade up until you can sell higher price cards, and that's really the best advice right now.
All right, cool. So that's all I wanted to cover with Puka. Thanks for your input on that. Brandon's got a cheating story.
Okay.
We are at an hour and 15 now. We're gonna cut down our plan of attack here a little bit, but go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. So I usually go in swings of not playing Magic at all to playing Magic competitively. And fortunately for everyone involved in this podcast, I'm at the very beginning of trying to play Magic competitively again. And so I had the fortunate opportunity to play $5 Modern event last week at one of the St. Louis shops. And so I go there, and this is a small buy-in event. And, I've got my scars. I got my crunk scars from playing in these tournament events. And sometimes it passes off onto these casual events, which is kind of bad. But at the same time, you know, you got to protect yourself. So we're sitting there round one, and the guy comes down and finds me and says hi. And one of the first things he does is he says, oh, hey, man, what are you playing today? And, you know, if you've been playing Magic for a while, that's just, like, not a question you ask somebody, because it's very important for your opponent to not know what you're playing, so they don't know what hand to keep for a mulligan decision.
Right.
So my standard response to a question like that is always, I'm playing Magic today.
Not a lie.
No, you don't want to lie. So then he makes a comment on my deck box, and he picks it up, actually. And he starts looking at it. And to be honest, the deck box is pretty sweet, so I don't blame him.
It's pretty fly.
These are these 3D printed deck boxes I've been working on, but we'll talk about those in the future. But what he does is he grabs it, and he looks at it, and then he says, how do you open it up? And so he opens it up, and at that point, he's seen my sideboard.
Oh, yeah, that sucks.
Right? And
sounds,
I don't know,
sketch as hell.
Super sketch, right? Like, would you do that if you're complimenting?
Bro, I think I would lose my cool much more than you would, but yeah.
Did he ask you then if he could put your deck back in the box one card at a time?
Because see how it fits. Yeah, so, this is super sketchy.
Yeah, so we go to present our decks, and his shuffle, he looked at his deck face up, put it in his hand, and kind of just, like, patted it against itself without actually shuffling it, then slid it across the table as a presentation.
Brandon, you're living in Missouri right now, right?
Hey.
This is that same state where they let you drive and drink a beer at the same time, right? I think this might be part of
that. There's not a time of day where you can't buy alcohol.
He lives in Hannibal where there are no lambs making noise.
So what would you guys do if somebody handed you a deck that they clearly didn't shuffle and just looked at an FNM?
I would shuffle it.
That's what I did. And then
I would shuffle the backs up of it.
He said, bro, why are you shuffling my deck?
I mean, at an FNM, this is part of the problem here. It's so casual that, I mean, what he did is, like, totally sketch. But at the same time, like, you don't really have any recourse. I mean, it's not like you're going to get a judge involved at FNM.
Is this guy a new player? Because you can't just, like, if he, this guy's a new player, it's not his fault. You got to educate him.
No, I was – he has three modern decks, and I was brand new to the shop.
I think I'd have a serious conversation is what I'd have. That's about the extent of what I –
shuffle the backs off of his cards and move on with your day.
Yeah. So he mulliganed into Oblivion, you know, all three games. I didn't do any Trevor Humphrey style. All I did was just, you know –
perfect.
Right, just simple hand, riffle, shuffle. Anyway, guys, point being, I feel like no matter where you are, just protect yourself against cheating. You know, don't tell your opponent what you're playing. Don't let them open up your deck box.
Yeah, stuff like that, obviously.
And if they seem shady, don't feel bad for shuffling their deck. Look, if it's FNM, I normally just tap someone's deck or I'll do a simple cut. But if you suspect something's wrong, just shuffle it, and if something's really wrong, just call a judge.
Just make sure you vigorously riffle shuffle it, too. People love that.
That brings up the bigger point, though, not just at FNM, but just at any tournament. Like, I think it's terribly important to be on point. Like, the level of people trying to do BS at some of these PTQs these days and stuff is just getting ridiculous. Like, everyone I go to, there's... like, some dude is either looking at my deck as he's shuffling and I have to say something to him, or just doing all sorts of shady tactics with his own cards. Like, I don't know if you guys have experienced that much at qualifiers, but it seems like it's just getting worse.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I think there's great things about Magic, and I think there's also things that have just gotten worse with time.
All right. Cool, so... moving on, we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit here and talk about a juicy deck tech, which is this, we had a different name for it, but Daryl likes to call it Glitters Like Gold. Is that right, Daryl? Or
That's a fine name for it. It's called Five Color Control. All
right, somebody fabulous than most, so.
All right, Daryl, take it away.
All right, so what you're going to see, it'll be in the show notes probably somewhere, is a deck list that I can type it up for you guys for a Five Color Control deck in Modern. So the thought is that Pillar of the Parents plus Reflecting Pool gives you perfect mana for any multicolored spell that you can think of to cast in Modern. Well, some of the most powerful spells in Modern, you have Lightning Helix, Abrupt Decay, Electrolyze. You know, your control deck staples, your mid-range deck staples are all multicolored cards. So you're just going to get access to a ton of insanely powerful removal. So I took it one more step and said, well, why don't I just have a toolbox deck and play four Glitter Meshes? And so you get a sideboard, and there are all sorts of beautiful hits in the sideboard. You get a Fiery Justice. For those of you who don't know, it's a 5 damage as you choose to any number of your opponent's creatures. They gain 5 life. You get utility cards, like you can put the last Abrupt Decay, the last Sphinx, or the third Sphinx of Revelation, things like that in your sideboard. But you also get these very powerful bullets against opponents, like Slaughter Games against combo decks, Blood Baron of Viscopa against Abzan, Is It Staticaster against tokens. So it gives you a lot of flexibility as to how you can play your deck in the middle of a game. You can change directions. You can say, okay, now I need the Glittering Wish to turn on the Jets and play an Assemble Legion and just kill you. Or I need to Glittering Wish now so I can Slaughter Games you late in 2 turns and take your win condition. Most of the power of this deck does come from, besides the Glittering Wish package, main deck Crackling Doom. It's a card that I don't see seeing a lot of play in Standard, but it's just really powerful. It's Edict Your Best Guy, so in Modern you're going to hit Tassigar, you're going to hit Tarmogoyf, you're going to hit Siege Rhino.
Thrawn.
You know, Sigarda, if your opponent went that deep, you're going to kill just the biggest thing. You're going to shock them, and usually that doesn't seem like a lot, but between 4 Lightning Helix, 3 Crackling Doom, 3 Electrolyze, and 3 Snapcaster Mage, you put together enough burn, usually, to just kill your opponent from 20 with just the incremental damage you can do them over the course of a game. If you guys have any questions as to how the matchups play out, why some of the cards are in the board the way they are, etc., feel free to fire away. I'll take them now. Otherwise, we can just kind of leave this for the viewers to sort of sort out themselves and ask questions about.
I'm curious, like, how's the combo matchup?
The combo matchup is a little tough. So you're kind of leaning on turn 2 Glittering Wishing into slaughter games for the appropriate combo removal card. And then you do have three counter flux main board. A lot of the combos in Modern are creature-based. They're Splinter Twin. I call Affinity a combo deck. You don't see too many non-creature-based like spell combos like Storm and things like that. So all of your removal spells double as combo interaction. And then if you really need to, like a Scape Shift deck or a Storm deck, you can turn two Glittering Witch for slaughter games. And slaughter games them on turn four unless they have discard. Every time they can't counter it, and you take Scape Shift or you take Grave Shot, and then you make them kill you on turn three. And if they can't do that, then you can kind of coast your way through the game, mopping up the Electromancers or mopping up the Thrag Tusks, whatever things your opponent used, Scar Tribuilders. And so those are the big three combo decks I see. If anybody else, you know, kind of has, well, how's your Bloom combo matchup? It's fine. You can kill their Primeval Titans with your Terminates and Crackling Dooms, and then kill the random layabouts with the Burn Spells, or you can just kill them with Burn Spells. So it's just sort of dependent on what your opponent's trying to do. You have to formulate the correct line of attack.
Yeah, man, now I played this deck. I got your list, Daryl, and I ran it on Cockatrice a little bit, and I have to say, I really love this deck. It's very reactive, though. And I played like one game that lasted an hour. It was so long. The Karn's ultimate went off, and like we like actually got pretty far into that second game that you play when Karn goes -14 on you.
Yeah. So you can actually never beat Tron.
Yeah. Well, I found that out.
You have to play a second game with Karn to beat Tron because you have to Glittering Witch for slaughter games twice.
Slaughter Seems games. Like a dex problem.
Slaughter games, Wormcoil. Slaughter games, Emrakul. They restart the game with Karn. You put your Glittering Witches and your Slaughter games back in your sideboard. Glittering Witches back in your deck. And then you Slaughter games Karn, and they can't kill you.
Yeah.
This is the thing I've thought already. It's very unlikely to happen. You just kind of concede to try. You're just like, I'm going to try and burn you out, and if I can, I lose. Whatever.
What about having Fulminator in that sideboard and Glittering Wish for that?
Glittering Wish for a Fulminator Mage?
Yeah.
Fulminator Mages are very effective unless you fire it off in multiples. So you would have to have a whole set of Fulminator Mages in your sideboard. And right now, Tron isn't even... I've been based the deck off of what I've been seeing on Modo. Because I play it on Modo a lot, as you can tell by the screenshot that'll be attached. And Burn and Splinter Twin and like very aggressive decks are the biggest decks on Modo right now. So in like the multiple of slot that I decided to be able to wish for and board in and kind of flex my board around, I put Rocks Warmonk because it's just way better against like the decks you'll run into more often. It's just a 3/4 lifelinker that'll gain you some life. It'll block a creature. It'll trade for a spell when you block. So that's sort of the flex slot that I went with. If you're walking into a meta where there's 20% Tron players, put 3 Fulminator Mages in your sideboard and Stone Rain their lands into a board game.
Are you playing Gaddock Teague?
Gaddock Teague is very bad in a deck that wants to cast Sphinx's Revelation.
Don't cast it, man.
That's not correct.
What about Maelstrom Pulse? Are you running that card?
There is a Maelstrom Pulse. The sideboard right now, the deck changed. I dropped it sort of in the chat, and I'll put it on the show notes so that you can see. It's an Abrupt Decay, a Wheel of Sun and Moon, which is attached to a player. Cards that go to the graveyard go to the bottom of the deck instead. An Izzet Staticaster, a Maelstrom Pulse, a Fiery Justice, 3 Rocks Warmonks, a Sultai Charm, an Assembled Legion, a Supreme Verdict, 2 Slaughter Games, a Blood Baron of Iskobla, and a Revelation.
You had a Rakdos Charm in there before, didn't you?
There was a Rakdos Charm, but graveyard-based decks were only like 2% of the meta on Modo in the top 60% of the decks. So I cut it because there wasn't a need for graveyard hate because it just came down to like destroy target artifact is the only relevant mode on it. So I put a Sultai Charm in instead because you get destroy target artifact and you can also kill a Tarmogoyf. And if you stabilize the board, you can also just turn it into like draw 2, discard a fetch land.
I really like Hide and Seek in there, man. Did you say that one?
Hide Seek is also cut because there's just not a lot of Tron. Okay. If there was a ton of Tron, you would play a Hide Seek in your sideboard, and you would like Seek Emrakul and then try and slaughter games. If you're trying to beat Tron, you can tune your board to beat Tron. Like that's the great part about this deck is that it's very tunable. The meta you know you're going to walk into, you can tune for it. If you know you're going to see 4 Affinity decks, you can put Fracturing Gust in your sideboard. You can put Fire Stout in your sideboard. You can put a bevy of these multicolored cards. It's just knowing what you're walking into is sort of the question of how do I handle the deck.
So, and Daryl, you might have said this, but so this is a control deck, right? And like the only counter spells you have access to, well, I mean, not the only ones. The only like consistent one you have is the counterflux, and you run the four counterflux in the deck.
There's
the
main three one. Counterflux. Three counterflux main. So there are only three counter spells. Other counter spells you can play are Counterspell, but it's just negate. And I died holding on to Charmogoyf, or dying to Charmogoyf while holding on to that card. So I wanted something more consistent, so I tried Punish Ignorance, which is white, blue, blue, black. Counter target spell, they lose three, you gain three. Ooh, but yeah. That was too slow. So you just wanted that like effect of gain three, lose three, because Lightning Helix is ridiculous. So I just cut those three extra counter spells and put three Snapcaster Mages in the deck, which are the only monocolor cards in the deck.
Too bad Undermine is not legal in Modern.
Sweet card. You would play Absorb before you play Undermine.
Oh, man.
Yeah, you need to gain life.
So the deck's very reactive, right? So my point is with the counter spells, like, there are a few cards that are removal spells that can also be pointed at the face, like Lightning Helix, but really the only proactive card in the deck is the Kuranos.
If there is a single Kuranos. Well, you can also Glittering Wish for proactive cards. Glittering Wish is, like, that's the whole flexibility of the deck, is that you have four cards that can act as a proactive card, giving you a Rocks Warmonk, an Assemble the Legion, a Blood Baron of the Scopa, a Sphinx's Revelation, which is a very aggressive card in this deck, because you draw five or six cards and you shut the door on your opponent because you draw like 12 points of burn in a Snapcaster Mage.
I did see the Rocks Warmonk addition in there, and that looked pretty spicy.
Yeah, there was one, but eventually I just decided that I needed more help against burn, so I just put it up to three. The Fiery Justice has been the only bad card in the sideboard, and it might become like another creature, maybe even the fourth Warmonk.
So this is version 2.0. I've been on version 1.0.
Yeah, right? This is
so
version 2.0.
I don't have the blood barons in my board and stuff. And basically the way that the deck that I'm running, that you created, wins is, you know, just like damage that's dealt with the Cackling Doom or Crackling Doom and all the other
Electrolyze
like,
and Helix, yeah.
Yeah, the one extra damage that gets dealt to the face with when I electrolyze their Birds of Paradise or something.
Correct.
it just adds up.
Yeah, like after the first Sphinx's Revelation with this deck, you tend to just start pointing electrolyzes at their face. You're like, all right, I'm going to draw a card, take two. I'm going to draw a card, take two. Snapcaster, I'll draw a card, take two. And you'll just do that to just draw more burn.
Have you tried different, like, angles with the deck just to see how they are? Like, you know, something where it is more aggressive, where you're playing, like, Lightning Helix, Blightning, that sort of thing, where you get the incidental damage in?
Blightning has been considered, but I didn't know how good like Lightning Bolt plus discard or plus Mind Rot was. I didn't really see a card I wanted to cut for it.
And granted, I'm talking about not the same shell that you have. I'm talking about taking the multicolored aspect of what you have
and making like a five color burn deck.
Well, yeah, going like a completely different line with it.
I think you would run short on burn spells because you would have Helix, Blightning, Electrolyze,
Crackling Doom.
Crackling. So you put four of each of those. So then you're like trying to reach for burn spells like Counterflux or Counterspell and we want to list off the main deck I request. So the main deck is the mana base is a mess. It's an Arid Mesa, four Flooded Strands, a Polluted Delta, one of each of the following dual lands, a Breeding Pool, a Godless Shrine, a Hollowed Fountain, a Sacred Foundry, a Steam Vents, a Temple Garden, and a Watery Grave. 25 total lands, and then 8 Rainbow Lands and some Vivids from Lorwyn, which are, they come into play tapped, make one color, and then can make any number, any color for removing a counter. They come into play two counters. So you're just trying to build a 5-color mana base off of a 25-land deck. That's why you have the 8 Rainbow Lands on that one.
And Vivid Lands were, like, I mean, they were part of 5-color control when it was a staple, too.
So. Yeah, when it was a standard deck, it was 5-color control with a bunch of Vivid Lands.
So now they're, like, necessary in there, I feel.
Reflecting Pool, yeah.
Yeah, we tried Mana Confluence. We tried Tendo Ice Bridge, or at least I did. Yeah. None of those cards were good. It's just Vivids are the best.
What about the spells, Daryl?
The spells is 4 Glittering Wish, 4 Lightning Helix, 3 Snapcaster, 3 Abrupt Decay, 2 Terminate, 3 Crackling Doom, 3 Electrolyze, 3 Counterflux, 4 Esper Charm, 3 Supreme Verdict, a Kuranos, and 2 Revelations. And then I already listed the sideboard of various wishables.
And 0 Siege Rhinos.
No Siege Rhino. I tested Siege Rhino, And it just didn't do it. You would just rather have a rocks warm up because you can wish for it and play it on five, yeah. which is like the turn that attacking burn creatures will sometimes kill you if they don't have an extra burn spell.
Well, if you have a creature, they have something to do with their removal.
So yeah, it turns on their searing effects, but a lot of times they have to like have the searing effect searing you, put you to like two, and then attack you. And so you trade your rocks warm up for their monastery switch spear. And you got a free card out of them, and then you gain 3 life. They have to skullcrack you. Yeah,
I feel like there's got to be a deck out, or there's got to be like a combo or two out there that we can just jam into this list since you're already playing Glittering Wish. I mean, it was so successful in the Jeskai Ascendancy combo deck in Modern, and obviously you can't play that one. But there's got to be something out there. Have you looked over anything to?
I've looked combos? Over all the multicolor cards. A lot of your good combos are one color, like just. Ad nauseam, Angel's Grace, stuff like that. It's all one color. So it's really hard to fit something in there.
All right. So I think we got to wrap up. We're at an hour and 33 minutes and 36, 37, 38 seconds. But before we do, Brandon wanted to do a non-magic segment at the end, and I'm not sure where he's going with that, so I'm going to let him start with that.
This is just so you guys can understand our personalities a bit and, you know, remind everyone that we're not total nerds, even though we really are.
No, we are.
So, yeah, let's just give something that we did this last week that's kind of cool. It's not exactly magic related. I guess mine. So we were going to do a leg day segment today relating to cards. We ran out of time. But today I went to the gym and I actually did real leg day. And so I have a Y membership and I haven't really been using it a whole lot. And so this past week I've been going every day after work, which is great. So I'm just trying to keep that up.
Yeah. All right. I'm glad, man. I was worried about your legs. They were looking kind of scrawny. I wasn't sure if you're going to like be able to sit in a chair all day and play magic.
It's going to waste away.
Yeah. Well, on the topic of that, anyone have anything else to non-magic talk about here?
Well, as some of you may know, riding my motorcycle is my second favorite hobby to magic, and we've had some amazing weather up here, including a 70-degree day, but now Madison has decided to grace us with snow again at the end of March, so that put a damper on that.
Oh, I thought your third favorite thing was riding your motorcycle in the snow.
Oh
yeah, this weather's pretty unbelievable that it went back to that. I'm sure some of you guys saw on Facebook, but yesterday I was coming back from Omaha and hit a patch of ice on the highway, and my wife's car went flying 360 into a ditch.
Oh my god!
Oh, good.
Yeah, so we were pretty thankful. I'm like glad we were even alive because it was crazy. I mean. Yeah. It was one of those things where we were just lucky there was no traffic around because we went through two lanes and 10 feet into a ditch.
Is the car wrecked?
Yeah, car's wrecked. It's getting fixed.
That's what you're talking about.
Yep. But yeah, so this Wisconsin weather can leave anything.
Man, my disc golf game that I got in before the snow sounds much less exciting now.
Oh, I was really excited. Play some disc golf.
I was really excited. I got to dust off the frisbees. They had the baskets out last week, and I dusted off the frisbees. And I was going to do it again today before the podcast, but they decided to drop 4 inches of snow on my life. So I was very sad.
I thought they usually wait till like May to put those up.
They were out a little bit, and then they, like, realized that the snow was going to be coming again, so they took them back, and I was like, oh.
They're like, metal. Then, what's going to happen to them?
They'll rust when the snow melts.
All right. Fair enough.
Yep.
Okay, well, I'm a band teacher. I was at Solon Ensemble all day on Saturday, which meant that no Friday night's midnight pre-release for me and no Saturday pre-release because I was instead at a high school for like 8.5 hours while kids played some music.
Oh, that's terribly exciting.
Corey Murphy goes back to high school.
And yeah. I don't know if any of you guys plan on doing this, but I'm about 90% confirmed that I'm going to go to the standard PPTQ this Saturday. So I'll probably have some information from that for next time.
Is that at Misty?
That is at Mox Mania.
Okay, I'll be there instead.
Yeah. We get a dollar every time we say Max Mania.
I'm playing Bees. I'm playing Dirt Ward Bees. The four Court of Calling, Flash into Hornet's Nest, and block your Siege Rhino to get four Bees. And I've got, like, main deck Setessan Tactics. It's pretty BA.
I take it back. I will not be attending that.
Because I can't beat that day.
Now the Bees are sweet.
Oh, they are sweet. It's like that. You ever see that Oprah gif where, you know how she gives stuff out at the end of the episode? I'll put this in the show notes, too. It's like she says, yeah, like, she has a surprise for everyone in the audience, and then she's like, bees! And then there's just, like, bees flying everywhere. And, like, everyone's screaming because, like, in reality, like, they were really excited about what she was giving away. But they also look like they're, like, just in total terror as, like, this, like, swarm of bees is, like, released on the audience.
Yeah.
I always think of Oprah when I play that deck.
So, Corey, you really like bees?
I love bees.
Yeah, you can see bees' nuts.
Oh, man, I knew that was coming.
Well, now it's... talk to the man firsthand, because Durwood is he's living in Madison now.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So, yeah, he'll give you that bees tech.
Oh, shoot, man, he's going to show me up. I hope he's on bees. I was tweeting him about that, and he says it's good. I think it's good. I think it's so good, but I got my butt kicked to just about every other deck I played at the last Standard event. I went with it. So we'll see. Not discouraging enough for me to not play at this PPTQ on Saturday.
All right. Does that wrap it up?
Yeah, you want to talk Twitter? I have a Twitter.
That sounds good.
Pass on me. No Twitter. No social media.
Okay. I've got two followers on my Twitter, so I actually have to look at what my Twitter account name is. It's new to me. It's either CD Sandwich. No, wait. Is it the @ underneath my name? I think it's the @.
Yeah.
Right. So while he's figuring out Twitter.
If you want... let me pull up the manual real quick, guys. It's @ Hold Music MKE for Milwaukee. Hold Music Milwaukee. One word. @ Hold Music Milwaukee. So do whatever you do on Twitter to be my friend.
Sure, man.
He needs a third follower, people.
I'll put it in the show notes. No, Zhuming, you're doing it wrong. MKE.
Oh, I see.
Zhuming Twitter.
I do not have a Twitter yet, as just like Brandon, but we will have Twitters up so that all our lovely listeners can follow us, because I'm sure they want to.
John.
Yeah, my Twitter is Red Deck Winning. You know what kind of content you're getting from that, so.
Fireballs and mountains.
Yeah, so if you like islands, just don't.
It's all about Jace, right?
Yeah, it's all about that Jace.
Tybalt in reality.
So
never be talking about Tybalt.
I'm gonna whore myself out a little bit here on Twitter @ Big Deasy Rider. I'm gonna start firing up my stream again. I did that a little bit at the end of 2014. We'll be streaming the 5-color control deck we talked about. We'll be streaming Miracles. We'll be trying to have a good time on Twitch. Same name, Big Deasy Rider. Feel free to fire in texts or questions on Twitter. We'll have a mailbag whenever you guys fire in questions. We'll take all of the mailbag, all the tweets. We'll answer the questions on the show. That'll be great. Do you guys have anything else?
There's a bunch of stuff in our little text tweets, our text message thing that we kind of passed over. We'll have to hit it next week if that's cool.
I got one more thing.
Okay.
One more thing? Go ahead. Is that it?
That was it.
You got your car fixed, and that's the new horn, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, then I think we're done for today. Cue exit music. Cue outro music.
Yep.